Welcome, everyone, and thank you for standing by. I would like to advise you that today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All participants will be in listen-only mode until the comment sessions of today's call. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mark Durden. Thank you so much. You may begin.
Hi, this is Dr. Durden from National Government Services, and we'd like to welcome you to the open meeting today. As the operator told you, this meeting is being recorded. And to facilitate the transcription of these minutes, we would like for you to introduce yourself by name when you first start your presentation. I also would like to remind you that if you're going to be making comments, that we would like for you to articulate your any conflict of interest that you may have prior to the reporting of your comments. For the speakers that have already been identified, I believe we already have their conflicts of interest that will be identified, so you can refer to them in your presentation. If you go to the next slide, I'd like to introduce the contract medical directors that are with us today, and that's Dr. Awadeli, Dr. Boren, myself, Dr. Mullen, Dr. McKinney, and Dr. Noel. And what I'd like to do now is turn the time over to Dr. Noel so that she can start with the proposed LCDs, starting with salvage high-intensity focused ultrasound treatment for the prostate. Dr. Noel.
Thank you, Dr. Durden. We have several LCD drafts to go through today, so we'll get started. Just as a reminder that those who are giving presentations today have 10-minute limits. If you reach your 10-minute limit, we will warn you a minute before that occurs, and then we will cut you off when it gets to 10 minutes. So the first up is DL38262, Salvage High-Intensity Focused Ultrasound Treatment in Prostate Cancer. This was a reconsideration request. And in actuality, we received three reconsideration requests from providers this year. These three requests were somewhat related and were sent in with some duplication of the literature provided to the contractor for review. The requesters wanted coverage for HIFU for primary treatment of prostate cancer in either the whole gland or the affected side of the prostate, or have the policy retired. After reviewing the literature provided along with societal guidelines, no changes were made to the coverage guidance of this policy. There are no plans to retire this policy at this time. Next slide. HIFU has not been compared with other standard treatment approaches in randomized trials, nor is it included in guidelines for the initial management of males with prostate cancer from expert groups. Clinicians should inform patients considering HIFU that the treatment option lacks robust evidence of efficiency, and that efficacy, and even though HIFU was approved by the U.S. FDA as existing technology for destruction of prostate tissue, it has not been approved for the treatment of prostate cancer given the lack of long-term data on outcomes. Next slide. The role of ablation techniques as an alternative to radical prostatectomy or radiation therapy for the definitive treatment of prostate cancer remains uncertain. Potential advantages in men with localized disease include the ability to destroy cancer cells using a relatively non-invasive procedure, as well as sparing normal tissue. These procedures are associated with minimal blood loss and less pain than surgery, and there is a more rapid post-treatment convalescence. Although HIFU most commonly has been used to treat the whole prostate gland, it has also been used for partial gland ablation, limiting apical treatment, in parentheses, in an effort to minimize potential complications. However, this may increase the risk of cancer persistence. Longer-term follow-up is required to assess both functional and oncological outcomes before this can be considered a standard approach. Next slide. At least some reports would suggest local HIFU may be less effective in treating anterior prostate cancer lesions as compared with posterior tumors. One approach to ensuring that all diseases included in the treated field is MRI-guided local HIFU. While one early report of 101 individuals with intermediate-risk prostate cancer is promising, follow-up is limited and additional studies are needed to evaluate the long-term functional and oncological outcomes from this approach. Next slide. Although the FDA has approved prostate HIFU as a minimally invasive treatment approach to ablate prostate tissue, HIFU is not included in several international guidelines of the initial management of men with prostate cancer. One of these, a joint guideline from the American Urological Association and the American Society for Radiation Oncology, Society of Urologic Oncology, which was, endorsed by the American Society of Clinical Oncology, states that clinicians should inform patients considering HIFU that this treatment option lacks robust evidence of efficacy and that even though HIFU is approved for the destruction of prostate tissue, it is not approved explicitly for the treatment of prostate cancer. Furthermore, if HIFU is performed, limiting apical treatment to minimize morbidity increases the risk of cancer persistence. Similarly, as noted above, a German guideline on focal therapy for prostate cancer states that education about focal therapy includes HIFU should state that the equivalence of focal therapy to standard therapies for localized prostate cancer is not proven. They recommend that focal therapies, including HIFU, be limited to patients with unilateral localized low-risk prostate cancer who refuse both standard therapies and active surveillance. Next slide. Now we're going to hear from one of our speakers. Dr. Derek Lomas, are you present at the meeting, doctor?
I am here.
I'll let you take over and do your presentation. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you for allowing me some time to speak. My name is Derek Lomas. I'm assistant professor of urology at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Here today to speak on the topic of HIFU or high-intensity focused ultrasound. My area of expertise is in prostate cancer diagnosis, screening, imaging, and focal therapies for prostate cancer, including high-intensity focused ultrasound. I trained here at the Mayo Clinic, but I actually did a fellowship in London in the UK working under three of the world experts in prostate ablation and HIFU. During that time, I was introduced to the technology, saw some of the safety, the benefits, the effectiveness of the technology when used in an appropriately selected patient. This therapy in the UK was covered under their government Medicare or medicine scheme, the NHS, and accessible to any patient that would qualify for the therapy. Since coming back to Rochester a few years ago in Mayo, I have attempted to build a HIFU practice in order to offer this therapy to appropriate patients. Unfortunately, coverage for HIFU is not universal across all Medicare patients and varies depending on which jurisdiction they choose to get their treatment. We can go to my next slide. No contents of interest that are pertinent. Next slide. I won't spend too much time here, but a little bit about the mechanism. For HIFU, the ultrasound probe is placed in the rectum, which generates sound energy, which is focused to a point within the prostate. This generates heat, which destroys the tissue, including the cancer, within its field. It's much like a magnifying glass in the sun. If you focus it just right, you can burn a hole in something like a piece of paper, but if your hand was right in front of that magnifying glass, you wouldn't feel it. So using the same principle, we're able to offer this minimally invasive treatment free of any incisions to ablate the prostate. Next slide. So the current coverage determination is limiting use and coverage for those only having salvage treatment following radiation failure. It has several other stipulations as well. And Medicare patients in our region seeking HIFU for primary treatment of prostate cancer are denied coverage for the procedure due to this current determination. However, if we have these same patients that travel to another region that does not have a coverage determination restrictive in place, they can get Medicare coverage for the procedure. And in fact, that's what I've seen in my practice. We are a multi-site institution. I have several patients that were good candidates for HIFU that have gone down to our site in Arizona, which is covered by a different jurisdiction, and the procedure's been covered, and they've been able to have the treatment. I've also been able to offer it to Medicare patients willing to pay out-of-pocket for the procedure. But unfortunately, both of these are limiting access to the therapy, which means large out-of-pocket expense or travel is required, and not all patients can cover that. Next slide. Data. So I want to spend some time sharing the data that I think supports high-intensity focused ultrasound as an option for appropriately selected candidates for localized prostate cancer. In my practice, I use HIFU as a focal therapy, meaning I destroy usually half of the prostate or the half that contains the prostate cancer, sparing the rest of the surrounding structures, importantly, the urethral sphincter, which is important for urinary function, and the neurovascular bundles, which are important for sexual function. I'd like to share with you a couple studies that I think that show that it's a safe and effective approach with lots of patients. So next slide. So this first study, over 1,000 patients out of the UK, and at 5 years, they found that 91% of those patients were able to avoid radical treatment, surgery, or radiation therapy. Next slide. This study, so this was a study out of the center I trained at in the UK. This was 625 patients, and the primary outcome was failure-free survival, meaning patients that hadn't needed to move on to surgery, radiation, had cancer spread, or passed away from prostate cancer. At 1 year, of course, outcomes were great, but at 5 years, outcomes were very good. 88% of men had not failed therapy. And importantly, 98% of these men achieved pad-free urinary continence, and no patient was requiring more than one pad a day, compared to prostatectomy, where maybe up to a quarter or more of patients may have leakage, depending on technique. Next slide. So this is from the same group in the UK. I think I'm the seventh author on this study. This is almost 1,400 patients who underwent focal HIFU. 7-year failure-free survival was now 70%, suggesting good medium to long-term follow-up. This is over a 15-year experience. Another important aspect is it was very well tolerated, very low rates of high complications or high-risk complications. Next slide. A lot of people comment that says, well, that's European data, that doesn't apply to America. Well, our group out of USC and California looked at their experience with 100 patients using focal HIFU, and we can see the 2-year freedom from radical treatment was 91%, continence, zero pads was 100%, and there was no significant changes in sexual function scores. So these outcomes seem to be translatable across the pond. Now, systematic review, pooling a bunch of papers together. Now we have 4,200 patients, and again, rates of infield failure, treatment failure, 22%, and again, continence rates, excellent, and sexual function are excellent as well. Majority of complications throughout those over 4,000 patients were early and low grade. Next slide. So one of the comments will always be, well, there's no randomized controlled trials, and as we know in surgery, those are very hard to do, to randomize patients, certainly to blind patients, and many things in surgery happen in advance without a randomized controlled trial. But we do have match-paired analysis where we compare patients that with similar background, and we compare them against each other, and there was no difference in need for salvage therapy in this match pair analysis between surgery and radiation, or surgery and HIFU at 5 years. Functional outcomes, however, were better with HIFU. HIFU had half the rate of erectile dysfunction and about half the rate of incontinence. Next slide. Another match pair analysis out of the UK group. Again, failure-free survival at 5 years equal between the two groups. Next slide. So primary focal HIFU or HIFU in general appears to be a safe procedure with low complication rates and preservation of urinary and erectile function. It has good early and intermediate term outcome, and the evidence is building. I think HIFU should be available to appropriately selected patients, and coverage should not be restricted to salvage use. I would propose that our Medicare jurisdiction be brought in line with the remainder of the jurisdictions throughout the country who are not restricting the use unnecessarily, allow the providers to carefully select the patients that might benefit from appropriate use of this technology. And I think me sending patients to Arizona or opening a HIFU center at our satellite center in Iowa just to treat these patients and have them covered is probably not the best answer. Thank you for allowing me to comment.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. If you could forward anything in writing to our comments mailbox, I would appreciate it. We just found out that there's a problem with our comments mailbox, and we're trying to get that fixed. We may need to extend the date that we're accepting comments. It was set up to be November 12th, but we will extend that if we have any difficulty opening that mailbox up. Our next presenter is Dr. Thomas Fry. Dr. Fry, are you available?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep, I can. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. As the slide says, I'm Thomas Fry. I'm an associate professor of urology at the other Rochester and the University of Rochester, New York. I have specialized training in urologic oncology from the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, and my clinical focus is mainly on localized prostate cancer. Next slide. I have nothing to disclose, no financial interest in any HIFU companies or any support for this talk. Next slide. Just a brief agenda. You know, I want to, similar to Dr. Lomas, just give a brief overview of HIFU with the current publications, state where I think the limitations of the current LCD are, some recommendations, and then potentially a request to meet with the NGS medical staff, policy staff to discuss these options further. Next slide. So I think the real question is, where does primary HIFU fit within the proposed salvage LCD? And it really doesn't. And my patients that I see with localized prostate cancer who would be good candidates for this are limited because the current language limits it to patients who've only had salvage therapy. And it's not systematically covered around the U.S., where some of my colleagues in different jurisdictions are allowed to get this treated. And, you know, currently the only way that these patients could potentially get it in our area is if they paid out of pocket for this. And ethically, I think it's wrong that these patients would have to pay for their treatment of cancer out of pocket. You know, this is not a cosmetic type operation we're doing here. This is a quality of life and oncologic surgery. You know, like I said, only NGS is the only Medicare carrier that has this restrictive policy in place. And it really restricts patients who are looking for different options to treat their cancer. And I think we have good data now to support this. And, you know, similarly, I think it's somewhat inconsistent with our current AUA guidelines, and I will show that in a bit. Next slide. So just briefly, you know, as mentioned in the last presentation, you know, HIFU's benefit is the ability to precisely treat tissue. And what this allows us to do is to map out the prostate and to treat where the prostate is, leaving the unaffected prostate tissue untreated, thereby minimizing the side effects. Next slide. You know, and I think that if we look at this, I often get really frustrated with the comments that there's insufficient data or the safety profile has not been there, because I think it's just not true. We've got 15 plus years of clinical data. It's done all over the world. There's been 80,000 plus patients treated with this. And when we look at it from a patient benefit, it's an outpatient procedure. There's limited recovery. And really, most of these patients are back to their normal activities once the catheter comes out in a few days. The side effect profile is certainly much better than surgery and better than radiation, and it's repeatable. And I think that that's a key point with these sort of focal technologies where we're treating just where the cancer is. We can redo HIFU. They have other options. We haven't restricted them if a cancer were to come back somewhere else within the prostate. Next slide. So this is what's key. You know, I always talk to my patients that this is customizable. This is personalized medicine for their cancer. This is not one size fits all. And that's the benefit and beauty of a treatment like this. The more prostate tissue we treat, the more side effects a guy might have. So why put them through that? And essentially, if we can get good margins around the cancer, which we're able to do, then we can effectively treat the cancer and minimize the side effects. And it's able to treat anywhere along the posterior or lateral parts of the prostate. But the main advantage is maintaining the quality of life while getting good long-term cancer control. Next slide. This is a busy slide, and I just wanted to highlight that the clinical data that's highlighted in red are all studies that aren't included in the current LCD. And I don't want to go through all the details of this. You can look at this on our own, but essentially it's safe. There's minimal incontinence. The erections are spared, and I think usually anywhere between 70 to 80% of men are free of needing radical treatments at approximately 5 years out. And that's what I quote my patients who are interested in this. Next slide. Just looking at a couple of these papers, and Dr. Lomas did highlight on these, but, you know, I think this is a really interesting study here because, you know, the initial introduction brought up a point of there's no randomized trials. A randomized trial in prostate cancer is very difficult. It's a long and protracted disease. To show any benefit of treatment requires at least 15 to 20 years of follow-up. Along with that, we'd have to have significant equipoise in treating these patients if they were to be randomized between a radical treatment such as surgery versus a focal therapy treatment. And if you want to talk about randomized trials in prostate cancer, there's no randomized trial. The PIVOT trial is the randomized trial showing observation versus surgery. And there's no long-term benefit of surgery versus observation, except in a very select group of intermediate-risk patients. But that doesn't limit our patients from receiving radical prostatectomy, even though randomized controlled trials show there's no long-term benefit. So what's the next best step? I think it's a propensity-scored match study like this. It matched up the clinical factors, and what did it show? Patients who are in a radical prostatectomy cohort versus a focal therapy cohort, at 8 years out, there was similar oncologic control. So this is a paper I quote to my patients a lot. And I think that what that tells us is I don't know what the data is going to show at 15, 20 years out. But what I can tell them with pretty decent intermediate results like this, that at 8 years, you have a similar cancer control with focal therapy as you would with radical prostatectomy. Next slide. I think that this is the longest reported study out there from the UK, you know, almost 1,400 men, 15-year experience. You know, I think that the highlights here from a patient perspective is that adverse events are very low. This is a very safe procedure. And again, the freedom from needing any, the freedom-free survival or the not needing any additional radical treatment at 5 years out was about 75%. Again, I think it's, you know, really good intermediate control data that we have here that we can report to our patients. Next slide. You know, lastly, I think that if we look at, you know, a systematic review like this, almost 4,000 patients, 50 plus articles, it's safe. There's pretty consistent results. There's about a 25% chance of an infield recurrence over time, you know, and that's in line with the recurrence rates after radical prostatectomy. If you look at all comers to radical prostatectomy, about 25% will have a failure at some point in their life. But again, these patients maintain their quality of life along with this long-term cancer control. In my patients, I just don't see the incontinence. And the erections are preserved, you know, in 80-plus percent of the time. When I just looked at my data, it was at 90-plus percent of the time. My patients were still able to have erections sufficient for intercourse after a treatment like this. Next slide. And when we talk about guidelines, guidelines are very important for us in oncology. And if you look at the most updated American Urologic Association in combination with the Radiation Society guidelines, you know, they believe that it should be ablation may be considered in select appropriately informed patients. So I think
Dr. Fry, you're to your last minute.
Okay, thank you. I think I'm almost done.
So all right.
The needle's starting to shift a little bit within our guidelines, and we rely on these to appropriately treat patients. Next slide. So I think that just in conclusion, I think that we've gone through these, but, you know, hopefully we give this a serious consideration. I think the data has changed. Our guidelines have changed, you know, and I think that it's time for patients in our jurisdiction to start being offered this as a case-by-case definitive treatment. Next slide. And I think that is it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is Dr. Silver available?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Go ahead and start, sir.
Great. Thanks so much for allowing me to address this public comment session. I have some prepared remarks. My name is David Silver. I'm a urologic oncologist in Brooklyn, New York. I'm a graduate of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. I did surgery and urology residencies, followed by a urologic oncology fellowship at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. I'm currently the chief of urology at the Maimonides Medical Center, the largest hospital in Brooklyn, New York, with 711 beds, and one of the largest house staff training centers in the country with over 26 ACGMA-accredited residency and fellowship programs, including our own five-year program in which we train the next generation of urologists. I'm also the director of the Maimonides Prostate Center, a subsidiary of our ACS-accredited cancer center. Now, at the Prostate Center, my colleagues and I see over 500 new prostate cancer patients annually. Many of these patients have prostate cancer limited to the prostate. The majority will choose standard whole gland treatments, radiotherapy, surgery, or in some cases, surveillance. However, an increasing number of these men find the risk of the quality of life side effects of standard treatments, namely incontinence and impotence, to be unacceptably high. And these men request alternative treatment in the form of partial gland therapy. In our center, we have offered high-intensity focused ultrasound, or HIFU ablation, to carefully selected patients since 2019. This treatment destroys only the portion of the prostate containing the tumor, spares the unaffected normal part of the prostate, and as you have heard from my colleagues, decreases the risk of quality of life side effects. In the past 3 years, we've successfully treated over 70 patients with HIFU, achieving positive and durable results consistent with the published literature that you heard presented. As expected, the patient satisfaction is quite high. Now, I and others have advised NGS in several communications of the international data supporting partial gland therapies in general, and HIFU in particular, some of which were presented previously. Specifically, this is not a new experimental treatment, but one of proven efficacy, both in the whole gland and partial gland setting, both for salvage treatment and as primary therapy. Nevertheless, NGS has inexplicably persistently reaffirmed an outdated, out-of-step, and unfair coverage policy, LCD L38262, the policy in question, limiting reimbursement for patients insured by Medicare within its geographic area only to salvage situations, namely radiotherapy failure alone. I'm speaking here on behalf of my patients, 85% of whom have Medicare or Medicaid, whose HIFU treatment has been denied by NGS consistent with this policy. On their behalf, I request retirement of this NGS policy. Now, here are my reasons. First, this policy is outdated. At the time of this local coverage determination back in 2020, evidence was presented indicating efficacy for local salvage of radiotherapy failure only. As you have heard, since that time, recognition of the significance of the index lesion as a driver of tumor behavior, coupled with the broad acceptance of surveillance for low-grade prostate cancer, has resulted in a significant shift in the treatment paradigm for localized prostate cancer, that is, primary ablation of the index lesion with surveillance of remaining low-grade disease is increasingly utilized. Simultaneously, additional evidence has accumulated both domestically and abroad of the efficacy of HIFU as an initial primary treatment. Now, NGS was advised of this evidence, including observational and matched pair studies, again, which you just heard. In fact, the localized prostate cancer guideline panel of my professional society, the American Urological Association, as well as two additional societies, the American Society for Therapeutic Radiation Oncology, or ASTRO, and the Society for Urologic Oncology, or SUO, after reviewing this same evidence, recently updated their guidelines in favor of ablation in general and HIFU in particular, stating, as you saw, the panel believes that ablation may be considered and select appropriately informed patients. This is a direct quote from the guideline. However, NGS analysis of this evidence emphasized only the short-term of follow-up and the unknown long-term outcomes, failing to recognize that HIFU, unlike other ablative therapies, can be readily followed by surgery or radiotherapy should this become necessary. Despite this, the coverage policy limiting HIFU to salvage radiotherapy failure remains inexplicably in force. Now, second, this policy is out of step with other Medicare Administrative Contractors, or MACs. Effective January 2021, CMS final rule established the CPT code for HIFU and set reimbursement levels for both facilities and physicians, irrespective of primary or salvage treatment setting. Of the 12 MACs, currently NGS alone has an LCD restricting HIFU coverage to salvage after radiotherapy failure. To my knowledge, the only other MAC with a similar coverage for salvage HIFU, WPS, has decided to retire it, allowing shared decision-making between the patient and physician on what treatment is appropriate for that patient's tumor. Today, my colleagues practicing in other jurisdictions confirm that their local MACs cover prostate HIFU ablation without regard to whether the setting is primary or salvage. This regional intransigence is similarly inexplicable. Finally, this policy is just flat-out unfair. Women with breast cancer can choose to have whole breast or partial breast treatment for localized breast cancer. In contrast, the current coverage policy for localized prostate cancer limits treatment choices for men to whole gland surgery or radiotherapy with surveillance or no gland therapy as the only covered alternative. Why are women allowed to choose how their breast cancers are treated, but men with Medicare administered by NGS aren't allowed a similar choice? Furthermore, why does NGS reimburse prostate cryoablation, a more invasive therapy with a parallel evidence base and guideline support, without any restrictions? In my opinion, since many private insurers do appropriately reimburse HIFU as a primary treatment for prostate cancer, and since, as I mentioned, other MACs cover primary prostate HIFU, NGS clinging to a policy that restricts HIFU treatment to patients with radiotherapy failure is clearly discriminatory. Why? I cannot imagine. In summary, NGS policy limiting prostate HIFU ablation to the salvage setting is outdated, out of step with other MACs, out of line with latest guidelines, and simply unfair to patients. This policy should be retired immediately. Thanks for your attention and the opportunity.
Thank you, sir. And we will take your comments under consideration during our comments. Now I need to ask if there's anybody in the general audience that wishes to make a comment on this LCD draft before we move to the next one.
Yes, and if you would like to share a comment at this time, please press star one on your phone and be sure your line is unmuted as you record your name. Again, to share a comment, press star one. One moment as I wait for any to come through. And I am showing no comments at this time.
Okay, we'll move on to the next LCD for reconsideration. Water vapor thermal therapy for LUTS/BPH reconsideration request summary of evidence. The indications of coverage in this LCD were expanded to allow coverage for prostate volumes of 30 to 120 cc's based on the analysis of several studies. Previously, the amount allowed was below 120 at 80 cc's. Do we have any comments on this draft in the general audience? There were no speakers on this topic.
And again, for any comments at this time, please press star 1. And I am again showing no comments at this time.
All right. And then the last draft is DL-33398, transcranial magnetic stimulation reconsideration request. NGS co-hosted a CAC meeting with multiple other contractors on 9/29/21. The panelists reviewed the literature that was submitted as part of the LCD reconsideration request to expand the policy to include coverage for OCD diagnosis. The literature was reviewed and noted to be challenged by small sample sizes, high risk of bias, and many studies with lower quality study design with a lack of control arm or blinding, short follow-up, 4 to 5 weeks for most studies with lack of any long-term outcome data and lack of real-world application of the technology. Overall, the panel felt there was potential improvement for OCD with TMS, and it appears to be safe, but limitations in literature are substantial as described. Next slide, please. There is currently insufficient evidence to show use of TMS for OCD as reasonable and necessary for the treatment of illness or injury in the Medicare population. TMS studies have heterogeneous populations, vary in frequency and site of stimulation, have mixed results and short follow-ups. The investigations are in their infancy, with one randomized double-blind controlled study looking at 99 patients with a 12% dropout rate and a 4-week follow-up. With the exception of Roth et al., the patients in the literature submitted for LCD reconsideration were participants in the CARMI et al. Trial of 2019. There was insufficient information to support coverage of TMS to treat OCD. The ability of TMS to improve outcomes in patients with OCD is yet to be determined. Do we have any speakers for this topic? Scott Blackman, are you available?
Hello.
Mr. Blackman?
Yes, you have to open my line. I'm here.
I can hear you. The operator has to open your line.
Sir, your line is open. You're speaking into conference.
Okay.
Yeah, we can hear me.
Great. Thank you. Next slide, please. Okay, my name is Scott Blackman. I'm the Director of Market Access for Brainsway. I'm also a member of the Clinical TMS Society's Insurance Committee. Next slide, please. My goal today is to briefly go over the review that NGS did for TMS for OCD and point out some of the limitations, brief background on the treatment continuum, a comparison of the TMS coils, and also a review of the evidence and patient selection criteria that would be appropriate. Next slide, please. In general, NGS reviewed 7 of the 10 studies that we submitted a year and a half ago back in March. None of the 4 additional studies that we've sent in the past year and a half have been included. To include the NGS reconsideration dated August 1st. The challenge has been that the evidence summary that you just pointed out combined all OCD TMS coil studies between 1980 and currently for OCD treatments. And they reached a conclusion that based upon all these other trials that were small with mixed protocols, there were mixed results. The figure eight coils have not been studied using the FDA-cleared deep TMS for OCD protocol. Yet all the studies that didn't use this protocol were included with mixed results and mixed protocols to make a decision of mixed results. So ultimately, deep TMS with the H7 coil for OCD is the only FDA-cleared system based upon effect in the studies and a proven treatment protocol. It should be reviewed separately. Next slide, please. As you mentioned, all of the studies you reviewed lacked standard protocol with the exception of deep TMS that was approved. The studies were small, low quality ratings, high risk of bias. There was short-term follow-up, different brain regions, a variety of frequencies from low, medium, and high, lack of real-world application, and what's clinically meaningful. Next slide, please. So the question that you really have to ask is, since deep TMS is the only one that had effectiveness trials to gain clearance, you should really be looking only at the demonstrated parameters within the protocol, brain region, stimulation frequency, sessions, and duration, in order to assess coverage for your Medicare patients. Next slide, please. Number one, there is a protocol that was approved by the FDA by deep TMS. The medial prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex were the brain regions that were stimulated at 20 hertz, 29 sessions for about 18 minutes each, and with a brief provocation. Next slide, please. This is an analysis of all the evidence you reviewed. The challenge with your analysis is that you're lumping all of these protocols with the effectiveness protocols by deep TMS, seen in green on the bottom. If you look at meta-analyses that basically analyze and summarize all of the TMS studies, they got the same response. When you're adding in all these non-approved protocols with the mixed outcomes, mixed brain regions, mixed frequencies, and different numbers of sessions, you're still getting mixed results. And those are highlighted in yellow by Ren. And I don't know if you can see my cursor, but you notice the frequencies were anywhere between 1 and 20 hertz. Brain regions were everything. And of those meta-analyses, only one of them included a deep TMS trial, and that was only our pilot trial, and it was an interim analysis of only 43 patients, not the actual trial, the multi-center pivotal trial used to gain clearance by the FDA. Next slide, please. In general, I want to make Medicare aware that OCD is not a depression. It's not a short-term episode. It's a chronic disease. Usually takes 14 years or longer before somebody actually seeks treatment. The challenge is that OCD has a lot of comorbidities with anxiety, mood disorders, and major depression. And even 50% of those patients will have suicidal thoughts. But reality is if you don't treat the OCD, it can be a limiting factor to patients getting well with the other disorders. Next slide, please. In terms of being appropriate for the Medicare population, Medicare covers about 62 million beneficiaries, but of those beneficiaries, over 9 million patients with disabilities are under age 65. If you look at those patients under 65, 34% of those patients qualify due to mental disorders. And of the patients under age 65, nearly two-thirds or 65% have cognitive and mental impairment. Next slide, please. Ultimately, the patients appropriate for deep TMS for OCD would be a very small portion. In fact, if you look at NGS, of the 11 million patients that they take care of or beneficiaries, only about 24,000 might be appropriate. And those are the ones that would actually be having treatment for OCD, and more importantly, the ones that wouldn't respond to their first-line psychotherapy or meds. Next slide, please. The challenge is that there's limited treatments. SRIs is only four of them and one tricyclic. And then psychotherapy. The challenge is only 50% of them might get a response, but the other 50% don't get a response. But yet, they still go on, and they're not getting well. So in the treatment continuum, where do they go after they fail this? They go on to more intense of the same, residential facilities, inpatient or outpatient facilities for a longer period of time. Next slide, please. The challenge also is that these therapies lack durability. There's been no proven long-term effect of this past a month for medications. Same thing with psychotherapy. Next slide, please. Specifically, if you look at this picture, brain regions which are stimulated, it's a circuit disorder. But specific brain regions that were used in the protocol to identify effectiveness to treat OCD, in the center picture, you can see in pink the dorsal medial anterior cingulate cortex, or DACC, is actually located deeper in the brain, about 3 centimeters subdural. If you look at the picture on the left, that in the front left of the blue is the medial prefrontal cortex, which is not as deep, it's actually shallow. Next slide, please. All the TMS coils are not the same, and they don't stimulate as deep or as broad as the deep TMS. If you look in the center, the BrainsWay H7 coil approved for OCD can stimulate 3 centimeters subdural, that's below the skull. That's 4 times deeper than the coil on the left, which is the figure 8 coil, which only goes 0.7 centimeters subdural. And all the way on the right, the DB80 coil, which is also cleared for OCD, only goes 1.2 centimeters. But more importantly, not only does the H7 coil go deeper, but broader. Ultimately, it's stimulating a lot more neurons, stimulating a much greater intensity of that circuitry for OCD. Next slide, please. This is an electric field diagram comparison of all 3 coils. The H7 is on the top, the figure 8 on the bottom, and the DB80 in the middle. Orange or red is actually good. And what this actually shows is that the red are neurons being fired at either 80 to 100 volts per meter, because that's what it takes to fire a neuron. And as you can see in the H7 coil on the top in red, much greater depth and breadth of stimulation of these neurons is occurring, much greater than the DB80 and the iron core. Next slide, please. Most importantly, I mentioned the anterior cingulate cortex. That's shown in blue. Stimulating this region of the brain has been implicated in OCD. And the H7 on the far right, you can see the orange at the top, much greater depth and breadth of firing of the neurons to reach the ACC as well as the medial prefrontal cortex. And if you look at the DB80, they have very little intense stimulation as shown in the red, and the yellow shows a moderate amount of stimulation. So the coils are not all the same. And next slide, please. So the point I just want to stress is that only the deep TMS coil has gained FDA clearance based upon effectiveness studies. There are no effectiveness studies with either the MagVenture DB80 coil or the NeuroStar Figure 8 coil using the FDA-cleared protocol. It was only based on benchtop modeling of electric field stimulation to show that they were roughly about the same. That's how they gained substantial equivalence. So the reality is, if you want to compare trials to show effectiveness, you have to have effectiveness trials with these other coils, and you should not confuse the outcomes of the other trials or studies they had with small patients in different protocols with the actual effectiveness studies that were shown to the FDA to gain clearance. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. In terms of evidence, I just want to highlight the 4 in green. These are ones that were submitted but were not reviewed or included in your review. I want to specifically look at, on the right, the Harmelic trial, which looked at the real-world evidence and the long-term durability of deep TMS for OCD, as well as the analysis of what treatment would be most effective for patients failed their first-line treatment.
Mr. Blackman, you have less than 30 seconds left.
Thank you. Next slide. Next slide, please. Deep TMS in the multi-center trial showed 38% response or 30% improvement. Real world showed almost 60% response. Next slide, please.
Mr. Blackman, your time is done.
Okay, can I summarize? May I summarize at least?
You may summarize. I'll give you 20 seconds.
Thank you. Next slide, please. Next slide. Durability was 2 years. The durability was 2 years, with almost 90% of patients having durability for a year or longer, and improvement in functional disability. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. In summary, you have almost 90 million people being covered for OCD, to include Palmetto, Medicare, and also Centene, which covers deep TMS, and the 2 largest Blues, Healthcare Services and Highmark, and now Cigna, Evernorth, with 17
All right,
million.
That concludes your presentation. Sorry. Operator, can you please check to see if there's anybody else that would like to make a comment on this topic?
Absolutely. Again, if you would like to share a comment at this time, please press star 1 on your phone and be sure your line is unmuted. Again, for any comments, it is star 1. And we have a comment from Carlene McMillan. Go ahead, please. Your line is open.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Carlene McMillan. I'm a psychiatrist in New York City and co-chair of the Clinical TMS Society's Insurance Committee. I just wanted to state that we're strongly in favor of expanding coverage of TMS to include the OCD diagnosis in light of the recent research regarding the H7 coil. I've just treated many patients with severe OCD with this coil who truly found it to be life-saving. And unfortunately, my Medicare patients have not been able to access this, resulting in ongoing disability as well as high overutilization of medical services for various somatic complaints that are related to the OCD. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your comments. And if you could forward that into writing to our comment mailbox, we would much appreciate that. That goes even for our planned presenters. If there's no one else with comments on this topic, I will turn the meeting over to Dr. Oladele about FFR.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Oladele, and the next draft up for comments is non-invasive fractional flow reserve for stable ischemic heart disease revision. And that is DL39075. This is being brought to the open meeting to discuss a revision of the existing policy based on 2021 AHA, ACCASC, CHEST, SAEM, SSCC, SEMR guidelines for the evaluation and diagnosis of chest pain executive summary. Within these guidelines, the committee gave a moderate strength of recommendation to expand the role of FFRCT in special clinical settings as an alternative to stress tests. Next slide, please. The FDA-approved FFRCT technology may be considered reasonable and necessary in the management of patients with intermediate-risk patients with acute chest pain and no known coronary artery disease, with coronary artery disease stenosis of 40 to 90% in proximal or middle coronary artery on CCTA, or intermediate risk with acute chest pain and known coronary artery stenosis of 40 to 90% in a proximal or middle segment on CCTA, or stable non-obstructive coronary artery disease with persistent symptoms requiring further testing and 40 to 90 stenosis on CCTA, and not in conjunction with stress testing, that is, unless FFRCT was not high quality and alternative study is needed. And intermediate and high risk is as defined in the 2021 AHA, ACC, ASE, CHEST, SAEM, SCCT, SCMR guideline for the evaluation and diagnosis of chest pain. Next slide, please. So we are now, the policy is going to reflect that FFRCT is considered not reasonable in the following clinical circumstances: prior placement of prosthetic valves, known severe aortic stenosis, prior placement of grafts in coronary bypass surgery, suspicion of acute coronary syndrome, where MI or unstable angina have not been ruled out, intracoronary metallic stents, status post heart transplantation, a recent MI, which is described as 30 days or less, prior pacemaker or defibrillator lead placement, newly diagnosed systolic heart failure with no prior left heart catheterization, left main coronary artery disease with intermediate coronary stenosis, defined as lumen reduction less than or equal to 30%, non-obstructing stenosis, which is less than 50% of all major epicardial vessels on CTA or catheterization in the past 12 months in the absence of a new symptom complex. If turnaround times may impact prompt clinical care decisions, high risk defined by left main stenosis is greater than or equal to 50%. I think that, okay. Also to note is that this service should be performed in patients with stable coronary symptoms. It should not be performed until after the Bay study, CCTA, has been completed and interpreted. It should not be used, it's not for use, basically, in the high-risk patients or when myocardial infarction has not been excluded. If higher-grade stenosis, that is greater than 90%, are present, this study is not medically necessary as the patient should proceed to catheterization. And low-grade stenosis, that is less than 30%, do not require additional confirmatory data. I think that might be it. Okay. Well, I just think that's it. Okay. FFRCT should be performed as an alternative to stress testing. Based on this recommendation, a new requirement has been added to the draft LCD that the FFRCT will not be covered in conjunction with stress testing. If extensive plaque is present, a high-quality CCTA is unlikely and stress testing is preferred. While the FFRCT offers the benefit of another test not needing to be performed at a separate time, clinical judgment will be necessary to limit to clinical circumstances that a high-quality FFRCT study will be expected. If FFRCT is not high-quality, that is, cannot be read, and stress test is selective as alternative studies, then eligible for coverage. Changes that have been made to the policy essentially are, number one, expands stenosis range to 40 to 90% and alters vessel-specific limitations to align with guidelines. Two, it removes the limitation on BMI based on new data. Number three, it defines intermediate and high risk by 2021 guidelines. Number four, it allows FFRCT as an alternative but not in conjunction to stress testing. Okay, is that the last slide? Yes. So, operator, could you please open the line if there are anybody on the line? We didn't have any presentation requests on this, but let's check and see if there's anybody on the line that would like to comment on this draft LCD. Thank you.
Absolutely. Again, if you would like to comment at this time, please press star one on your phone and be sure your line is unmuted as you record your name. Again, to make a comment, please press star one. And I am showing no comments at this time. You may proceed.
Okay, thank you. Absence of any comments current on the line right now. At the end of the meeting, we will be letting everybody know what either the temporary box to send comments are or what our decisions or plans are in extending comment period. Thank you. I will hand over to the next presenter, which I believe is Dr. Boren.
It's Dr. Durden, and I'll take over.
Dr. Durden, sorry.
It's okay. The next draft LCD that is before us is the sacroiliac joint injection and procedure policy. And by way of background, this policy development was started with a multi-jurisdictional subject matter expert and advisory committee meeting, which was held for this policy development on March 10, 2022. The teleconference was hosted by National Government Services CGS administrators, Meridian, Palmetto, and Wisconsin Physician Services. As you may know, the sacroiliac joint is a unique but very challenging joint complex, and the pattern of innervation is not specifically clear for the posterior and anterior aspects of the joint. In fact, pain from the SI joint can be quite variable and cause varying degrees of pain. The literature for sacroiliac joints is also limited by very few placebo-controlled randomized trials, by the lack of long-term data, several inconsistencies in the diagnostic criteria, the assessment of the outcomes in those studies, and the unique and the techniques that are used for the procedures, resulting in a very high heterogeneity between the studies. After careful evaluation of the medical literature and utilization of the best evidence which we were able to obtain, we've made some determinations in regard to coverage and guidelines. These coverage guidelines in the LCD, the draft LCD, are supplemented by the knowledge that was shared by our subject matter expert trial, which I alluded to back, that was held in March of 2022. SI joint injections will be considered medically reasonable and necessary when all of the following criteria are met, and these are six criteria. The first is that there's a moderate to severe low back pain, primarily experienced over the anatomical location of the SI joints, between the lower level of the iliac crest and the gluteal fold. And the low back pain has a duration of at least 3 months. And the low back pain is located below the L5 level without associated radiculopathy. And the clinical findings or the imaging studies do not suggest any other diagnosed or obvious cause for the lumbosacral pain. And at least three positive findings of provocative maneuvers, such as the Faber's test, Gangflin's, thigh thrust, SI compression, SI distraction, and the Yeoman's test. And the low back pain persists despite a minimum of 4 weeks of conservative therapy. When an SI joint injection is performed as a diagnostic injection, the diagnostic injection is to be used to determine if the etiology of the pain is from the SI joint complex and is considered reasonable and necessary as a diagnostic test when the patients meet all of the criteria above, the six criteria referenced previously, and the following criteria. That is, the SI joint injections must be performed under CT or fluoroscopic image guidance with contrast, and ultrasound guidance it may be considered if there is documentation that there's a contrast allergy or a pregnancy that's involved. Otherwise, ultrasound guidance is not acceptable. It's to be CT or fluoroscopic studies. Additional diagnostic criteria include the SI joint injections that are not performed for other SI joint injections are not performed with other musculoskeletal injections in the spine, and the documentation should show a direct causal benefit between the SI joint injection and that not related to other musculoskeletal injections or treatments, and the diagnostic SI joint injection provides at least a minimum of 75% of the primary or index pain with the diagnostic injection, meaning that the positive diagnostic response is defined as greater than 75% sustained and constant pain relief for the duration of the local anesthetic and greater than or equal to 75% sustained or constant pain relief for the duration of the anti-inflammatory steroid which was injected. And this measurement of improvement of greater than or equal to 75% needs to be measured by the same pain scale that was used at baseline. Next slide. In the billing of these diagnostic injections, it is important to note that no more than two diagnostic joint sessions, either bilateral or unilateral, should be performed. When a diagnostic SI joint injection is performed, a KX modifier should be appended to the line for all of these injections. The KX modifier will only be used for the initial diagnostic injections. Repeat diagnostic injections beyond the first one or two SI joint injections, which are required to perform the diagnosis and after the beginning of treatment, are not considered reasonable and necessary. Any subsequent diagnostic SI joint injections are not considered reasonable and necessary when the initial diagnostic block did not produce a positive response of greater than or equal to 75% pain reduction. Next slide. When you're determining the efficacy of the diagnostic injections, the pain scale must be done using the same pain scale as I previously stated. But the pain scale must also be obtained with a baseline injection that is done pre-injection on the day of the SI joint injection, and it needs to be performed post-injection on the day of the injection. And the post-intervention 2 pain scale needs to be performed on the days following the injection to substantiate and corroborate that the pain scores were consistent with the pain relief for the duration of the local and or steroid which was used. So let me just explain that a little bit more clearly. When the second post-intervention pain scale is to be done, it is to look for and be assessed following the time that the anesthetic and steroid response would have been obtained, and to obtain that information using the same diagnostic pain scales. The pain scales which can be used to measure pain or disability must be documented in the medical record. Acceptable pain scales include, but are not limited to, the verbal rating scales, the numerical rating scale, the visual analog scale for pain assessment, the disability assessment scale, the Oswestry Disability Index, the Oswestry Low Back Pain Disability Questionnaire, the Quebec Back Pain Disability Questionnaire, the Roland Morris Pain Questionnaire, the Back Pain Functional Scale, or the PROMIS Profile. Now let's move to the next slide, which is the discussion regarding therapeutic SI joint injections. Therapeutic SI joint injections will be considered medically reasonable and necessary for patients who meet all of the following criteria. The patients must meet all of the above criteria, which is for covered indications for SI joint injections. And I'll reference you back to the initial 6 criteria, which was discussed previously. Continuing on, therapeutic SI joint injections also require that the diagnostic SI joint injection provided a minimum of 75% pain relief of the primary index pain, with the diagnostic SI joint injection, i.e., it's showing that there's a positive diagnostic response, which is defined as greater than or equal to 75% sustained and constant pain relief for the duration of the local anesthetic, and greater than or equal to 75% sustained and constant pain relief for the duration of the anti-inflammatory steroid which was used and measured by the same pain scale that was used at baseline. Likewise, the measurement of pain, which was taken pre-injection on the day of the diagnostic SI joint injection, the post-intervention pain scale on the day of the diagnostic injection, and the days following the diagnostic SI joint injection are done to substantiate and corroborate that consistent pain relief was obtained for the duration of the local anesthetic and the steroid that was used. Therefore, if you go to the next slide, when performing subsequent therapeutic SI joint injections, these would be considered reasonable and necessary when the subsequent SI joint injection are provided at the same anatomical site as the first therapeutic SI joint injection. And the therapeutic SI joint injection produced at least a consistent 50% pain relief or at least 50% consistent improvement in the ability to perform previously painful movements and activities of daily living for at least 3 months from the proximate therapeutic SI joint procedure. And this is compared to the baseline measurements for the ADLs and or the painful movements or the pain relief using the same pain scale. Subsequent blocks not meeting this requirement are not considered reasonable and necessary. The SI joint injections must also be performed under CT or fluoroscopic guidance imaging for guidance with contrast. And the exception is that ultrasound guidance may be considered reasonable and necessary when there's a documented contrast allergy or a pregnancy prohibiting the use of the CT or fluoroscopic imaging. Finally, there is no more than 4 therapeutic SI joint injections, unilateral or bilateral, will be reimbursed for a rolling 12-month period of time. And the final slide and final point of this is that SI joint denervation, also called radiofrequency ablation or RFA, is considered investigational and therefore not reasonable and necessary. So the requirements are that the SI joint procedures should be performed in conjunction with conservative treatments. Patients should be part of an ongoing and actively participating in a rehabilitation program, home exercise program, or functional restoration program. SI joint injections may be performed unilateral or bilateral if clinically indicated within the same session. In regards to the documentation requirements, the documentation must also include the radiographic films or fluoroscopic images of the procedure in at least 2 views, and those will need to be retained in the medical record. And the documentation should also include a specific assessment of the duration of pain relief being consistent or inconsistent with the agent used for the injection and the specific dates the measurements were obtained using the same pain scale you found at baseline. For the functional assessment, the documentation must show clinically material improvement with the painful movements and the ADLs. So there needs to be specific information and documentation regarding the baseline as well as the improvements of those activities of daily living or the previously painful movements. I'd like to also now address the limitations. It would generally be not considered medically reasonable and necessary for the treatment of SI joint injections to extend beyond 12 months. Use beyond 12 months requires the following. The pain is severe enough to cause a significant degree of functional disability or vocational disability measured by objective scales. Next, the SI joint injection provide at least 50% sustained and constant improvement of pain and or 50% sustained and constant objective improvement in function using the same scale at baseline for at least 3 months. The documentation also needs to provide the rationale for the continuation of SI joint injections, including but not limited to the patients who are at high risk for as surgical candidates, patients who do not desire surgery, and or they have a recurrence of pain in the same location that was sustained and consistently relieved with the SI joint injections for at least 3 months. Finally, the primary care provider should be notified regarding the continuation of these procedures and prolonged repeat steroid use following the administration to allow for systemic care delivery, treatment surveillance, and multidisciplinary biopsychosocial rehabilitation. go to the next slide. SI joint injections involving the use of an anesthetic, corticosteroid, or contrast agents is encouraged, but it does not include the injections of any of the biologics, such as platelet-rich plasma, stem cells, amniotic fluids, et cetera, and or any other injectants. Another limitation is that it is not considered medically reasonable and necessary to perform multiple blocks, such as epidural steroid injections, sympathetic blocks, facet blocks, trigger point injections, et cetera, during the same session as the SI joint injection procedures were performed. SI joint injections to treat nonspecific low back pain, axial spine pain, complex regional pain syndrome, widespread diffuse pain, chronic pain syndrome, and or pain from neuropathy are considered investigational. SI joint injections used as part of a series of lumbar spine or musculoskeletal injections to treat nonspecific or chronic low back pain is not considered reasonable and necessary. And finally, patients with coexisting psychological conditions or depression-related illnesses should be treated and stabilized prior to proceeding with the interventional procedures. Multidisciplinary biopsychosocial rehabilitation principles should be provided for these patients. That concludes the presentation for the SI joint injection draft LCD. And I will open the line up for comments or ask the operator to open up the line for comments.
Absolutely. Again, if you would like to share a comment at this time, please press star 1 on your phone and be sure your line is unmuted. Again, that's star 1 for any comments at this time. And we have a comment from Scott Stainer. Go ahead, please. Your line is open. Scott Stainer, go ahead, please. Your line is open.
Oh, sorry. My name's Scott Stainer. I'm an interventional pain physician in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and member of the American Society of Interventional Pain Physicians. The one comment that I had just about the sacroiliac, that was just read about sacroiliac joint injections, I often use them as a diagnostic tool to determine if a patient would benefit from an SI joint fusion. I usually do a lateral approach. And a three-month interval between two injections seems a bit long to me because some people don't respond to the steroid, but it's helpful to know if they respond immediately to local anesthetic. And if they get a few hours of pain relief and you do that, you know, a couple of times, that's a pretty good indication. If you've ruled out other things like facet joints, et cetera, that's a good indication that the sacroiliac joint might be the pain generator. The five-year data for SI joint fusion is actually quite good, along with radiofrequency ablation for at least 6 to 12 months is also another option if they don't respond well to the steroid portion of the sacroiliac joint.
So Dr. Stainer, I appreciate your comments and really appreciate the time that you're taking to present at the open meeting. I do have a question for you. When you're only assessing for the use of the local anesthetic and you're specifically treating the SI joint, how do you know that you're not just getting a benefit from the injection of the ligamentous structures and not the actual joint instability problem when you're only assessing for local anesthetic?
Well, you do it in combination with a physical exam assessment, and then you use, of course, contrast dye in your injection to show that you're in the joint space itself. Now, I would concede that sacroiliitis is a somewhat of a diagnosis of exclusion, but there are many patients, especially those who have had spine surgery and have, you know, the facet joints are fused. and you perform sacral iliac joint injections, they don't get long-term relief, but at least short-term relief, and then I do a fusion for them, and they do quite well. Presumably because of the laxity of the joint ligaments, allowing the bones to rub together, the iliac crest or the ilium and the sacrum. And then when you fuse them together, then they sit tight, like they prior to the loosening of the ligaments.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any additional final comments, sir?
Are we going to be talking about SI joint radiofrequency ablation in a separate?
No, this comes as part of this. As part of this LCD, as you may refer to back about three slides, SI joint denervation, also called radiofrequency ablation, under this policy is going to be considered investigational and not reasonable and necessary. Would you like to address that point?
Well, I think that it should be allowed for us. The data for at least 6 to 12 months after SI joint radiofrequency ablation, I wouldn't call it excellent evidence, but it's at least moderate evidence shows that it is effective. And lateral branch block of the S1, S2, S3, along with the L5 dorsal ramus is a pretty good indicator of whether or not a patient would benefit from that radiofrequency ablation. And I just pointed out to you that I'll do SI joint fusion for these patients, which is covered, albeit you have to show that you, at least the guidelines that we have out here say that you have to do two sacroiliac joint injections, and they have to have 75% pain relief for the duration of, you know, the duration of the local anesthetic. But waiting 3 months to get that diagnosis seems a bit long to me. With the radiofrequency ablation, and what I was going to say is, I wish that there was something in between just doing a sacroiliac joint injection and an SI joint fusion to treat sacroiliitis, and that's the sacroiliac joint radiofrequency ablation procedure.
And how do you account for recommending the radiofrequency ablation when there is variability with the innervation of the SI joint, in particular the anterior and the posterior variance that occurs with the innervation?
You can't get the anterior innervation of the joint. But if you do diagnostic lateral branch block and dorsal ramus block, the L5 dorsal ramus, and the patient gets significant pain reduction for the duration of the local anesthetic, I think that's enough evidence to at least try ablating those nerves. Now, will they get complete pain relief? You're not sure. They get no pain, will they get complete pain relief with the ablation? Maybe not, but significant pain reduction has been observed in many studies. And in my own practice, that seems to be the case as well. I'll have patients that you'll do the facet joint denervation and still have some residual pain, and then you treat the sacroiliac joint and their back pain is pretty well controlled.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Stainer. I would encourage you, all comments need to be submitted in writing, we appreciate your verbal comments, but we would also like to encourage you to submit these comments in writing and also provide the references that you alluded to in your comments.
Okay.
Operator, is there anyone else that's needing to talk or be able to present for this draft LCD?
I'm showing no further comments at this time.
Okay. I will close discussion on that draft LCD and open the discussion for the draft LCD on pain management, which is being revised. The simple part of this one is that all references to the SI joint injections have been removed from this the current LCD on pain management, and so the draft LCD, which is going to now be described as pain management revised, will just simply have the absence of the SI joint injection. And I will open up the meeting for comments and ask the operator to open up the line for comments.
Yes, again, if you would like to share a comment at this time, please press star 1 on your phone and be sure your line is unmuted. Again, to make a comment, please press star 1. We have a comment from Eric Growling. Go ahead, please. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. Thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks for putting this meeting on. I'm president of the Connecticut Pain Society, a member of ACIP, and I am the CAC member for pain management in Connecticut. I practice interventional pain management in a private practice setting. I've done that for 15 years. Hello?
Dr. Grayling, you're still with us.
Okay, thank you. I'm hearing an echo. I guess I'm puzzled by this LCD, as was with the facets and the epidurals, is incredibly restrictive. It's onerous in terms of the documentation requirements. Having just for example to save 2 pictures of an SI joint injection in the medical record, we don't even have to do that for an epidural steroid injection, and that's a more invasive, higher risk, more involved injection. So that puzzles me. But unfortunately, I've lost faith in having been in the CAC process for over a decade. I don't really think, and my membership would agree, we don't really think that what we sort of propose and try to fight for and ends up being a difference in these hearings. But, with the facet treatments and the epidural treatments and the egregious restrictions thereof, you know, our opioid prescription have gone way up in the last 2-3 years since these new LCDs have been incorporated. And I know that wasn't the intent by any means of the carriers, but that's the reality. So I just wanted to make a point and get that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your comments. And Dr. Grayling, always appreciate you attending our open meetings. And just for clarification, I believe you are referring to the draft LCD on SI joint injections as opposed to the pain management revised draft LCD, but I understood the direction that you were taking. So thank you, sir. So as we come to a close for this open meeting, I again want to express my appreciation to all those speakers, particularly the busy physicians who have taken time out of their schedule to present to us. And we really do appreciate your comments. The comments are taken under advisement and incorporated into all the other guidelines and other National Society recommendations, subject matter experts, panels that have been convened in regards to these draft LCDs. As we conclude this meeting, as you recall, Dr. Noel indicated that comments need to be submitted in writing, and we are having some difficulty with the submission of that. But the official comment period is now open and will extend until November the 12th, 2022, and that these draft comments or policies are now open for comments. And we will accept everything in writing for those comments that need to be submitted. The current recommended location for the submission of these comments is Part B LCD comments at anthem.com. It is my understanding as well that we may be having some technical difficulties with accepting comments on this email address, so therefore I'm going to provide a second email address, and that is ngscmd@elevancehealth.com. I'll repeat that. That's ngscmd@elevancehealth.com. As we close this meeting, I just wanted to reiterate the comment period is open until November the 12th. And this will bring to the conclusion of this open meeting today, and we thank you for your attendance. Thank you very much.
That will conclude today's conference, and we thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.